Hey there, fellow travelers. Greta and I are off again this week. However, as I did with Tolkien's Requiem a few weeks ago, I've decided to give you a special gift this week. The first chapter of my second book, Tolkien's Overture, Concerning the Music of the Ainur. By the way, make sure to check out tolkiensoverture.com for more information on how to get the whole thing. Tolkien's Overture is available now in signed paperback, standard paperback, Kindle ebook, and audiobook via Audible. Thanks for listening, and enjoy. The creation of Middle-earth begins with Eru, the One, in a mysterious locale called the Halls of Iluvatar, beyond which there is only the void, a vast emptiness of nothing. What we will come to learn about Eru is that he closely aligns with the Judeo-Christian view of the all-powerful God, who is completely other and transcendent, and thus any vehicle of human imagination, words, images, or a combination thereof, will seem to fall woefully short when attempting to describe him. Thus, as a disclaimer, it should be noted that we are ultimately dealing in things of mystery, matters incomprehensible according to normal sensory and intellectual perception. These are spiritual things taking place, occurring on an altogether different plane and mode of existence than our own. Our intellects need to be capable of simultaneously respecting the descriptions contained herein and of realizing that they portray realities that transcend our imaginations. Ainur Lindale is truly written as though it were the story of an ancient, pre-modern people. It is an attempt to communicate transcendent realities to finite and limited beings who typically rely upon their senses for knowledge. But of course, isn't that what all music really is? Does Ainur Lindale have a plot? Ainur Lindale may not be incredibly long, but it's as dense as a neutron star. Fittingly, it progresses more like a great symphony rather than a modern pop song, taking on one theme only to combine it with another, seeming to repeat what has passed in varied form, developing past themes more richly even as new themes are opened up. Does Ainur Lindale have a plot? I believe it does, though it is not the sort of plot that one might see in your average blockbuster film or find in your favorite beach read. Though written in prose, Ainur Lindale is more poetic than most prose storytelling, a dancing prose, seeming always to return to a previous starting point, yet all the while leaving a trailing echo in its wake as it moves. Even so, I have come to discern a three-part structure within Ainur Lindale that I believe helps the mind begin to grasp it. While I have no reason to think that Tolkien intended this explicit structure, it nevertheless seems to fit quite well. Footnote 3. I do want to note that I think I discerned the structure by reading his poem Mythopoeia. It seems to describe a similar pattern of creative inspiration. So maybe he did intend it. These three parts are as follows. Number 1, the music. Number 2, the vision. Number 3, the reality. As I engage Ainur Lindale, these parts will serve as the basic structure of exploration. This chapter focuses on the first part of Ainur Lindale, the music, in which Eru Iluvatar creates the Ainur and leads them in the creation of a great cosmic music. Teaching the Ainur to play. Ainur Lindale begins with the creation of the Ainur by Iluvatar. These Ainur, the Holy Ones, are the offspring of his thought. To each of the Ainur, he propounds a theme. Each of the Ainur sings before Iluvatar, or in some cases, a few together do so. Let us pause here, for there's already a lot to unpack. Iluvatar is the originator of both theme and Ainur. The themes themselves are not persons, but the Ainur are. Why is it necessary for there to be persons to propound these themes? Why is it not possible for Iluvatar simply to propound them himself? These are significant questions. We are not told how many Ainur are created, but we are told that after some time of individual singing and the rest of the group listening, Iluvatar propounds to them a mighty theme that amazes the Ainur. With this, Iluvatar wills that they make a great music together. At this point, we begin to see why he created the Ainur in addition to the themes themselves. He wills that they might adorn the themes with their own thoughts and devices. In this, we gather our first glimpse of the idea of subcreation, that Tolkienian doctrine wherein the greatness and beauty of reality is increased by the embellishment of free spirits. In this, we hear echoes of Tolkien's creative manifesto on fairy stories, wherein he proclaims the effoliation and multiple enrichment of creation as one purpose of creative action. Through the voices of each individual Ainu, some new thing will be achieved. While this new thing is grounded in Ilúvatar's original theme, it is nevertheless a result of the individual freedom bestowed on the Ainu by its maker. Thus, it can be seen that Ilúvatar finds a sort of delight not just in the music itself, but in the creation of beings that are like him, capable of their own creativity and free thought. Indeed, knowing this, it seems fitting that the name given to Eru and Arda, i.e. the world of Middle-earth that is to come, is Ilúvatar, which literally means father of all. Ilúvatar is not just a father in the sense of being the originator of all things, but would seem to be a good father who wills an ultimate happiness for his offspring. He is a father who takes delight in his children's curiosity, playfulness, and personalities. Furthermore, we learn that it is not enough for Ilúvatar that the Ainur be individual contributors. He intends each to play a unique part, but he also intends that they should collaborate in the creation of an even greater music. I will now that ye make in harmony together a great music. Though each Ainur is a great being itself, they only reflect one limited aspect of Ilúvatar's thought. As they collaborate with their brethren, though, they create a greater unison and harmony and more deeply discover the majesty of Ilúvatar himself. And Ilúvatar finds great joy in the fact that through the Ainur, great beauty has been wakened into song. The first theme. After some time of teaching each individual Ainu the music he wills for them, Ilúvatar calls them all together and gives them a mighty theme that they should play together. What is a theme? Let us consider a familiar example. In musical terms, the theme of a work is generally its main melody. Consider Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. It contains one of the most recognizable themes in the history of music. As one listens closely to the symphony, one can easily discern the main melody of the piece, as it develops from the initial da-da-da-da motif, being carried along by the higher string instruments, violins. However, as one listens more closely, it becomes clear that there is much more going on than just the main melody of the piece. There are numerous instruments involved, including flutes, oboes, clarinets, bassoons, horns, trumpets, timpani drums, violins, violas, cellos, and double basses. Only one or two of these instruments may be playing the main theme at any given time. It is up to the rest of the instruments to fill out and embellish the theme, to make, as it were, a mighty and wondrous sound in unison and harmony. Now imagine listening only to the violin part. One would indeed hear the same general theme, but it would feel naked, spare, and minimal. It would in no way be the same as hearing the full symphony in all of its glory. This, then, is a fitting analogy for what Ilúvatar does here. He gives them first the main theme, and then it is incumbent upon the Ainur, using their individual intellects and particular skills, to beautify and glorify this original theme. The effect of this dynamic is wondrously described as follows. Then the voices of the Ainur, like unto harps and lutes, and pipes and trumpets, and viols and organs, and like unto countless choirs singing with words, began to fashion the theme of Ilúvatar to a great music. And a sound arose of endless interchanging melodies woven in harmony that passed beyond hearing into the depths and into the heights. And the places of the dwelling of Ilúvatar were filled to overflowing. And the music and the echo of the music went out into the void, and it was not void. For anyone who has ever found themselves overwhelmed by the glory of beautiful and multifaceted music, these words are a fitting approximation. Such great music has the ability to fill us abundantly, to overwhelm not only our senses, but even our spirits as well. It would seem that this music of the Ainur surpassed any music of which we might conceive, and we are told that after the end of days, others shall join in to a second music of the Ainur that shall surpass even this one in glory. This last point is key. Middle Earth begins in a great music, but ends in a music still greater. Indeed, this end is no true end at all, but only the beginning of the everlasting song. In that final music, it is said here, all things shall reach such a point of perfection that even as these themes are played, new reality shall come into being. For Ilúvatar shall give to the thoughts of those participating the secret fire. Yet we should not get ahead of ourselves, for these words are only a foretaste, a distant promise of a final glory. Though the music even now is truly beautiful, not all of the Ainur are of one mind together. Melkor's movement. Though at first the communal music of the Ainur is one of great beauty, it does not last. At this point, we are introduced to Melkor, who desires to interweave matters of his own imagining into the music of his brethren. Now alone, this may sound as if it were simply what the other Ainur were doing. Indeed, did not Iluvatar will that the Ainur should adorn the themes with their own thoughts and devices? The critical issue is that Melkor's imaginings are not in accord with the theme of Iluvatar. What does this mean? Imagine you are in a concert hall listening to a symphony orchestra perform Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. The great music begins, and you are overwhelmed at the kaleidoscopic beauty of the great sound. But then, a minute or two into the work, one of the trumpet players does something strange. He stands up and starts playing loud and discordant notes without any semblance of melody. And not only is it not in accord, it utterly clashes with the main theme. It's not as if he's undertaking a jazzy embellishment of the work. It's more like he's seeking to deliberately disrupt everyone else. That is apparently what Melkor does. Why does he act thus? We are dealing here in arcane matters, but the text tells us that Melkor has two basic reasons for acting thus. First, he wants to increase the power and glory of the part assigned to himself. Second, he wants to fill the void with his sound. Melkor apparently feels that the void is being ignored, that Iluvatar has given no thought to it. What does this tell us about the spirit of Melkor? It would be easy to come right out and simply speak of Melkor as a prideful being, and certainly from early on in the Silmarillion we know of him in this way. He seems to be filled with contempt for the other Ainur. But we can see here that there is something sympathetic in Melkor, the desire to fill that which is void. Melkor has a vision of what the void could be, of what things could fill the vast emptiness that, from his perspective, Iluvatar and the other Ainur have given no thought to. We learn that Melkor loves the void precisely because he desires to fill it, to bring things of his own imagining into being. Furthermore, he has gone out into the void to search for the flame imperishable, and has grown impatient with Iluvatar for not filling it. He has become a wanderer in search of paths ever new. And here's the kicker. Because of his wandering, Melkor had begun to conceive thoughts of his own unlike those of his brethren. While the rest of the Ainur are off making harmony according to the themes given them by Eru, Melkor is exploring the vast unfilled void, searching for the flame imperishable. While he is far off wandering, he apparently loses touch with the minds of his brethren, and his thoughts go out of sync with their thoughts. Something like contempt begins to spring up towards them within the heart of Melkor. "I have seen and dwelt within the void," he thinks to himself, "while my brethren decided to stay put and sing only those songs given to them." Additionally, why was he looking elsewhere for the flame imperishable? This is indeed another tricky point. If this flame was with Iluvatar, why did Melkor go looking for it elsewhere? Did Melkor not realize that's where it was? Did he hope to find some other part of it elsewhere? Did Melkor hold Iluvatar in contempt for some reason, assuming him a pretender to the flame? Was Melkor perhaps blind to it? I think that the flame imperishable is something like what we'd call free will, that thing capable of giving a unique spiritual life to created beings. Later, in Chapter 2, we learn that the Ainur named Aule has created the dwarves. When his creation is discovered by Iluvatar, he is told that the dwarves will have no being of their own apart from his, because only Iluvatar can give to beings a life all their own. "For thou hast from me as a gift thy own being only, and no more. And therefore the creatures of thy hand and mind can live only by that being, moving when thou thinkest to move them. And if thy thought be elsewhere, standing idle." Thus, it is perhaps that Melkor was searching for the flame imperishable so that he could give life to beings he already had in mind, things that he assumed had not even entered into the mind of Iluvatar. Melkor has no time to spend with the minds of his brethren, to sing in harmony, to draw ever closer to them in fraternal unity. He has far too many things to accomplish. What follows, we learn, is discord. Melkor begins to weave into his music some of these thoughts that are not in keeping with Iluvatar's own, and those near to him begin to grow despondent. Anyone who has ever played in an orchestra or large music ensemble can have some sense of how this will work. All the instrumentalists are playing together in perfect synchronization and harmony. If one of these players, particularly one on a loud instrument, were to begin doing something obnoxious and cacophonous during a particularly pastoral section of the music, it would throw the other players off, especially if they were unprepared for it. Those nearest to him would be affected, and they would find themselves having trouble keeping in sync with the other players. Indeed, some may even find it easier simply to join in with the false theme, to attempt to do something loud and cacophonous themselves, either believing the music to have changed to his strange theme or believing it better just to go along rather than sound like a complete disaster. Indeed, it's even possible that some of the Ainu found something alluring and wonderful about Melkor's proud theme, and its boldness and might. This here is not the same old thing we've been doing, but something new and bold and full of the void, which I now see has its own strange beauty. And so the melodies which had been heard before foundered in a sea of turbulent sound. Melkor's singular discordance becomes its own great music, which threatens to overrun the previous music, the theme of Iluvatar. This is described as a raging storm and an endless war. To be sure, there is music in these things, but it is not the music of harmony and beauty, at least it would not seem to be in the way that Iluvatar intended it to be. This is more like anti-music, a shadow of what music is intended to be. Melkor's theme apparently threatens everything, and to many of the Ainur it must have appeared as if Iluvatar had decided to give everything over to him. Some time elapses, we are not told how long, and then all of a sudden, Iluvatar intervenes. The second theme. According to the text, the Ainur perceive that Iluvatar smiles. This would seem like a Mona Lisa smile, a wry expression with an ambiguous meaning when considered at the surface. Is Iluvatar happy that Melkor has been disrupting the harmonious music of the other Ainur? Surely this can't be, for it has obviously caused great distress to the others and resulted in a theme of raging storm and endless war. How could these things possibly make Iluvatar happy? Even as Eru smiles, he lifts up his left hand and a new theme emerges amid the present cacophony. What can we make of this new theme? Is it a mere reaction to Melkor's work? Or is it a theme altogether new? We are told it is like and yet unlike Iluvatar's former theme, and that it gathered power and had new beauty. Coming as it does amidst Melkor's cacophony, it would need to be powerful enough to emerge through that noise, the same noise that seemed to drown Iluvatar's first theme. As for its being like and yet unlike the former theme, we are not told in what way this is. Most of us probably recognize this sensation when it comes to hearing music. An artist may produce a song using a melody or riff, and then change something about it later so that it sounds the same, yet seems altogether new. One can see this operative in James Horner's music for The Fellowship of the Ring. Even in a short piece like Concerning Hobbits, the initial theme opens and then is changed, almost transfigured, by a shift in rhythm and instrumentation. And then, further down the line, a brief twinge of sadness, a minor key interrupts the flow and something even newer emerges. Yet finally, the song is able to resolve on something very closely resembling the introduction, though not exactly the same. The music is changed, but it is not completely and utterly different. Though it seems that Iluvatar has produced something capable of withstanding Melkor's assault of noise, Melkor is not finished yet. Even as the second theme emerges from the sea of sound, Melkor's discord arises with a vengeance and an even greater war of noise results, a noise so great that many of the Ainur simply cease their playing altogether. Who's in charge here, they must be wondering. According to the text at this point, Melkor is. Melkor had the mastery. Melkor, created by Iluvatar, seems to be winning in what has gone from a beautiful and harmonious music to a war of noise. Yet as we might expect, Iluvatar is not finished yet. The third theme. Even as it seems Melkor has regained control of the cosmogonic symphony, Iluvatar lifts up his right hand and a third theme arises out of the overwhelming din and musical chaos. Where the second theme was like and yet unlike the first theme, this third theme, we are told, is completely unlike the others. Ah, something new. We aren't going to be just repeating this cycle of theme leading to noise, leading to change in theme, leading to more noise. Iluvatar is not going to give the mastery over to Melkor in a final way, though it may seem like it for a time, perhaps even long enough for many of the Ainur to become despondent of making harmonious music ever again. We are told that this theme at first seems soft and sweet, which doesn't exactly sound like something capable of contending with the great cacophony swirling about the throne of Iluvatar at the moment. Soft and sweet sounds like something that would be easily overwhelmed. Yet this same theme, a mere rippling of gentle sounds and delicate melodies, grows slowly, for it could not be quenched. Eventually, it takes to itself power and profundity. All of this represents a new tactic on the part of Iluvatar. No longer does he seek to counter the incredible noise of Melkor with immediately great themes, but instead he lays in something that grows and grows until it becomes powerful and profound from within the cacophony. Even so, neither Melkor's chaotic noise nor Iluvatar's third theme ultimately gains mastery. We learn that they seem to progress together while simultaneously being utterly at variance. You have probably experienced something like this before. Perhaps you are driving along listening to a classic rock station, and then someone pulls up beside you listening to country at full blast. Our brains seem incapable of processing the competing musical strands as separate things, though at times we can pick out the different tunes in this situation. Still, it is in no way a pleasant sensation, this warring of musical voices, and with enough exposure to it, it is liable to drive most of us insane. It seems that we are wired so as to need a certain inner harmony, and when we don't have that, we become unbalanced, perhaps even physically ill. The Beauty of Sorrow. Iluvatar's third theme is described wonderfully here. It has gradually and subtly risen to the point where it is deep and wide and beautiful, but slow and blended with an immeasurable sorrow, from which its beauty chiefly came. There is great vividness to this description. If we were just talking about the first four descriptors, deep, wide, beautiful, and slow, I hear in my head the pastoral symphony from Handel's Messiah. If I close my eyes while I listen to that, it evokes within my mind a vast and green valley between great mountains, flowing with rivers, creeks, and the possibility of endless and wonderful discovery. This is a happy and peaceful place, a place of bliss and rest. However, the immeasurable sorrow proves problematic. I have trouble identifying that sound in my head, for it inevitably ends up feeling rather, well, Melkorish. To be sure, I can handle sorrow, but it's the immeasurable part that provides the greatest problem for me. When I think of sorrow, I can think of sadness, but it's not necessarily a sadness that overwhelms. Instead, it's like a rainy day, something I've always found beautiful in and of itself, a gray shade amid the world. However, attaching the modifier immeasurable to sorrow leads me to think of a sorrow that is capable of overwhelming someone, even of leading to despair. Now, it could be that I am misunderstanding what Tolkien meant here. If it is possible to understand immeasurable in this way, as a thing that overwhelms the heart, it is also possible to understand it in a way capable of meaning something that cannot be described in a quantifiable manner. It could be that this sorrow is simply immeasurable in its beauty, or vast enough to seem immeasurable. In this idea of immeasurable sorrow, I hear echoes of what Tolkien referred to as Christian joy in a 1944 letter to his son Christopher. In that letter, he remarks, "Such joy produces tears because it is qualitatively so like sorrow, because it comes from those places where joy and sorrow are at one, reconciled, as selfishness and altruism are lost in love." It is a strange thing that intense sorrow should lead to intense beauty and joy, but this echoes the Catholic conception of the Passion of Christ. Though Christ has risen from the dead and reigns now in glory, the joy of this truth ever abides with the knowledge that he had to endure incredible sorrow and pain to achieve this. Indeed, it is in the Apostle's letter to the Romans that the idea of intense pain and intense joy are connected in a marvelous paradox, when he makes the mysterious proclamation that, "For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. Perhaps it is only that such a measurable sorrow could be truly beautiful if there is a certainty of hope to follow. Yet for any reader of The Lord of the Rings, one can easily detect the beauty of such immeasurable sorrow and the way Frodo is never quite the same again after he returns to the Shire from his ring quest. And musically, we can know this implicitly, for who can deny the beauty of the immeasurable sorrow contained in any number of beautiful musical compositions? Indeed, how can we not sense the beauty in the immeasurable sorrow of Howard Shore's theme, which accompanies the Rohirrim as they charge into the jaws of death at the Battle of the Pelennor Fields? It may be that music is the most potent instrument for encapsulating the mysterious beauty of such immeasurable sorrow. A Violent Unity. The second music we hear of is the great music of Melkor. It is described as loud, vain, endlessly repetitious, containing little harmony, and resulting in a clamorous union. This is not the unity of harmony, but the unity of rhythm, the music of the machine. Whereas the music of harmony works so that two or more parts complement each other and form something new and wonderful, seeming to contain a life all its own, Melkor's music pushes ahead automatically, hungry to make itself heard and get done what it wants to get done. It will scream and shout without any concern for the pollution it makes, bulldozing its way through the music of the other Ainur. Footnote 4. I think here of the great armies that battled during Tolkien's lifetime in the World Wars. The armies of various nations were certainly unified, but it was for the sake of trampling other armies. Domination was the goal of this unity, not greater beauty. End footnote 4. According to the text, it seems to drown the other music by the violence of its voice. It hopes to win a war of attrition, to utterly reduce all that resists it to rubble. What we also find in this, though, is that there is really nothing particularly clever or original about it. It is pure will, pure force, pure might, lacking in anything resembling skill or art. It screams, "I am great. Bow before me." Yet a wonderful thing happens here. Even as Melkor's music belts out triumphant notes, the theme of Iluvatar seizes these notes and weaves them into its own pattern. Though Melkor's music seems great and mighty, it does not succeed in accomplishing what it seeks to accomplish, but instead provides new notes to take Iluvatar's beautiful themes to even greater heights of glory. Hidden in this, we might indeed find the mystery of sorrow's beauty. If Melkor intends malice toward his brethren and their works with his music, then it is a wonderful irony that what should be his greatest triumphs are in fact used to bring about even greater triumphs for the cause of harmony and beauty. The harder Melkor blasts his own horns, the more beautiful the theme of his brethren becomes. The greater Melkor's effort to mar and destroy, the greater the resulting beauty and glory. The music ends. Still, Iluvatar is not content to let this war of music continue forever. And so, arising from his throne, he puts a stop to it as a great conductor might conclude a symphony. This final chord, it is said, is deeper than the abyss and higher than the firmament, a mixture of hyperbole which again calls to mind the mysterious paradox of immeasurable sorrow leading to transcendent joy. Despite Melkor's conceited aspirations and contentions, Iluvatar is still in control. I hope you enjoyed that passage from Tolkien's Overture. Make sure to visit tolkiensoverture.com for more info on how to get the whole thing in audiobook, paperback, or ebook. Don't forget, signed copies are available, and make great gifts for yourself or the other Tolkien fanatics in your life. Thanks for listening, and until next time, the road goes ever on.